Mouth.
Word of 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 mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Our cultural fascination with poison dates back millennia. Socrates is said to have been sentenced to death by hemlock. Legend has it that Cleopatra took her own life with the bite of an asp. Poison was responsible for the deaths of several Shakespearean characters, and Agatha Christie used it to kill off 30 victims over the course of her 66 mystery novels. The Power of Poison is an exhibit at the Museum of Natural History in New York, and it explores the enigmatic nature of poison in the environment, myth, murder, and medicine. I'm joined by the exhibition's curator, Mark Siddall, from the Museum's Division of Invertebrate Zoology. Mark Siddall, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
The New York Times wrote that the exhibit at the Museum of Natural History has been perpetually packed. Why do you think we humans are so fascinated with poison?
Other than the alliteration of perpetually packed for the power of poison, I think that there's a lovely duality that runs through history, literature, human experience in terms of our relationships to poison. They're unseen agents, unseen actors in sort of a very deep historical context. They run through storytelling, not just Western storytelling, but even Choctaw legends in the southern United States or Chinese or even African legends about the origins of death that relate to poison. We've nonetheless been leveraging poisons for our own benefit for millennia, whether it's in terms of medicines or for hunting or fishing. It's an incredibly fascinating topic that has a lot of different facets to it. It was really quite challenging to try to capture the sense of fascination and the sense of power, both from a biological perspective, from a literary perspective, and from all the societal aspects that we could have brought to bear.
Well, I imagine it was pretty fun, though. I mean, from somebody who works in the Division of Invertebrate Zoology, wasn't this kind of a dramatic, good one to put together?
It was a lot of fun. It was an embarrassment of riches in many ways because there's so many directions that we could have taken it, and I think we took it in exactly the right direction, trying to explore really, in fact, the power of poison, but not just the power in terms of the chemical toxins, but also the power to inspire literature. We go everywhere from ancient Greek legends of Hercules and the Hydra, right up through where science comes into play. As you said, for example, with Agatha Christie, God, there isn't a poison that she didn't use in a book. And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and some of the stories about the origins of forensic toxicology.
Well, there are four categories, as I understand it, in the exhibit: poison in nature, poison in myth and legend, villains and victims, and poison for good. Let's start with the myth and legend, which looms so large. Some historic figures who may have fallen victim to poison, Cleopatra. It's a true legend has it that she had an asp bite her in her breast in seclusion.
You know, it's so funny. This is like a game of telephone. So the business of the breast was invented by Shakespeare. And if you go back to the... Well, exactly. But the asp bite, which was originally on her arm before Shakespeare decided it would be more titillating to put it on a breast, was that she was able to off herself with an asp. And of course, a European asp is, while it's a venomous snake, it's not terribly venomous, and it's certainly not going to kill you. Cleopatra, it turns out, was well-versed in the art of poisoning and envenomation. She is reputed to have taken prisoners and had various snakes bite them to see the outcome, so she would have been an expert. That being the case, certainly an asp would not have been the snake of choice. Perhaps an Egyptian cobra would have done the job. It's more likely that someone gave her a poison to drink or suffocated her in her sleep or something like that than it was that she got bit by a snake.
Well, then there are the real stories of the suicides. Hitler's number two man, Hermann Goering, used cyanide to kill himself the night before he was to be hanged at Nuremberg.
The only Nazi to do it.
And much more recently, the Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko died in 2006. He had been an officer with the KGB. What did poison do to him, and how did they detect it?
Oh, polonium is really nasty stuff, and it's largely because of the radioactivity of it. What's interesting about it is while it only takes minute doses because it's so incredibly radioactive to off somebody with polonium, because it's so incredibly radioactive, it is not a poison of choice because it's very easily detectable. They were able to find residual radiation all over the place with that individual. And then, of course, there's Sergei Markov. This was actually a much more difficult case to solve. Sergei Markov, I believe, in the 1980s, who was a Bulgarian dissident, was poisoned by a ricin pellet shot into his leg from an umbrella gun. Oh, I mean, this is the stuff
Avengers.
No, exactly. And you know what's interesting is it was always sort of debatable whether or not that could actually happen until Adam Savage and Jamie Heineman in the Mythbusters, you know, the television series.
Mm-hmm.
In the very first episode of the first season, this is one of the myths they tested. I actually have Adam's umbrella gun gas charged thing here in my office. He's a friend of mine, and he gave it to me for the opening of The Power of Poison to show people. But it turns out you could actually do this.
Well, okay, so what you're pointing to is the kind of mystery and sinister nature of
and intrigue.
Poison.
Intrigue.
Well, right, so does death by poison just have that built in?
I think it does, because it's really difficult to figure it out. This is why it's the stuff of stories by Agatha Christie and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. It takes some sleuthing. It takes some good science to try to figure out what's going on in toxicology. But you can imagine a time when even chemistry was difficult to understand and wasn't something that was normal to be used. And it's only been since 1830, 1850s even, where this has been brought to jurisprudence.
We're speaking with Mark Siddall. He is the curator of the Power of Poison exhibit that's at the Museum of Natural History in New York until August of 2014, so you can see it for yourself. Poison is natural, of course, however. What evolutionary purpose does poison serve in nature?
Well, as I implied, it's not unlike talons or teeth or body size or speed. If you're a plant and you can't run away, you're defending yourself with something. And often that's a poison or a toxin. What's really fascinating is where you get into what we call Red Queen evolutionary arms races. We tend to think of the incredible power of scorpion venom or of diamondback rattlesnake venom as being something that's offensive. But it's way more powerful than is necessary to subdue the prey that they're going to eat.
Uh-huh.
What's happened over the course of millions of years is that diamondback rattlesnakes are fed on by possums. Opossums have this inherent resistance to the venom. Opossums with more resistance are more likely to succeed, so that ratchets the argument up one way. And, of course, rattlesnakes that have a more powerful venom are more likely to at least make the possum go to sleep, and they have a chance of getting away. And you end up with very powerful resistance and very powerful toxins in the venoms of the snakes because they're being fed on by possums. It's referred to as the Red Queen hypothesis in evolution. It was developed by a guy named Van Valen, because just like in Through the Looking Glass, written by Lewis Carroll, everyone's running just as fast as they can to stay in one place.
And it's possible in Lewis Carroll's story that they're all tripping their brains out because mold on their bread or had become poisonous
mold on. You know, I'm going to go in a really different direction with this. The mold on bread,
yes.
You can get rye bread, which I had for breakfast, interestingly enough. Rye bread, there's a possibility of getting ergot. It's a fungus that can grow on bread. And it's actually, in fact, what someone historically isolated LSD from. It's very neuroactive and modifies brain chemistry and so on. Very closely related to a completely different fungus that infects the brains of ants and turns them into zombies, where they go up underneath a leaf,
right.
Hang on to a vein of the leaf. They're completely taken over by the fungus, and then they drop all the fungal spores to the ants below.
But I'm curious for you. I mean, you are in the rainforest. Is there an animal or a plant or an insect that would scare you the most?
I have the same sort of immediate reaction that I think a lot of people have to snakes. If I see a snake, the hackles on my neck go up. It turns out most snakes, even the incredibly venomous ones, are not that dangerous unless you try to pick them up. They'll see you long before you see them, and they'll scurry off and scurry away. There are a couple of snakes that don't do that, though. And in Africa, The puff adder, for example, is one that is rumored to always damage the second person in line.
Huh.
The first person in line on the steps or in the grassland will agitate the snake. It doesn't run away. It simply recoils and waits to strike, and of course the second person comes along and gets the strike. Puff adders, even though they're not the most venomous of all snakes, the most venomous snakes are actually in Australia, puff adders probably kill way more people a year in Africa than any other snakes, except perhaps Russell's viper that has a similar behavior in Asia.
Well, the rattlesnake is, you know, something that looks and sounds through our lore to be frightening and poisonous. The giant silkworm caterpillar, however, sounds pretty benign. What is its defense?
Well, these guys, Linomia species in South America, very, very prominent spines on their backs and often some bright colors. So the sort of thing that if you look at it says don't touch. And if you happen to touch and you got stung by one of these, there would be a very unfortunate outcome. It's not unlike, for example, being infected by Ebola or Marburg virus. The condition is called disseminated intravascular coagulopathy. It sounds basically by activating all of the coagulation factors in your blood, the things that normally allow you to clot, instead of getting a clot, you're just left with nothing left to keep the integrity of your blood system, and you end up bleeding out of all kinds of different places, out of your pores, out of your nails, out of your eyes. It's quite horrible. Thankfully, very few of these stingings and envenomations by the caterpillar have ever occurred, but it's quite horrific.
You said very early on that the double-edged sword of poisons, or the two sides, the paradox. Where do we see poison being used for good today, in medicines, for example?
Well, medicines are the obvious one, and of course this goes way back to traditional medicine and certainly the origins of modern medicine with, for example, aspirin. Aspirin is just a sialic acid that you get from a lot of different plants. I think the original one was a willow, but you can find it in wintergreen, acetylsalicylic acid or other sialic acids. We've been using compounds from leeches. The very first human dialysis treatment was only possible because of a hemotoxic component, a blood toxin that is in the saliva of the European medicinal leech. Some of them are a little more subtle, and I like the story of the Brazilian pit viper. Someone had studied the effect of the Brazilian pit viper's bite on small mammals and saw that those small mammals had a precipitous drop in their blood pressure. By studying how that toxin worked, they discovered a completely new enzyme in the mammalian system called ACEs. These are angiotensin conversion enzyme. The name's not important, but by discovering this particular target, other people were able to discover drugs that would inhibit angiotensin conversion enzyme, and now ACE inhibitors are the drug of choice for controlling blood pressure in humans. So it wasn't the toxin of the viper that is being used. It's a drug that's targeting the same thing that the viper's toxin targets. There's even the Chilean rose tarantula. There's a compound in its venom that's under investigation to control heart fibrillation. The Gila monster in the Sonoran Desert of the United States has a compound in its saliva that causes a precipitous drop, not in blood pressure, but in blood sugar. And now this is a $750 million a year drug called exenatide that is helping people with type 2 diabetes. We're continually learning about how animals have and plants have already figured out how to interfere with physiologies and trying to leverage those for our own benefit where we can.
Mark Siddall, thank you for warning us of all the poisons in the universe, or at least some of them.
It's been a great pleasure. Have a great day.
Mark Siddall is curator of the Power of Poison exhibit at the Museum of Natural History in New York. The exhibit is on through August of 2014. You can find a slideshow of nature's deadliest creatures on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. If you're attracted to exotic animals from faraway climates where the colors are brighter, the species are stranger, and poisonous creatures thrive, you'd have found plenty at the New England Reptile Expo in Manchester this past weekend. Always on the lookout for an adventurous family outing, producer Taylor Quimby took his wife Tiffany and 2-year-old Phineas to check it out.
Finn, can you tell me what you see?
Snakes. Big snakes, Dada.
Really big snakes, that's right.
The New England Reptile Expo falls somewhere between a trade show and a petting zoo. Displayed across the length of the Radisson Expo Center are thousands of geckos, iguanas, turtles, frogs, and of course, snakes. Lots and lots of snakes. Indiana Jones would totally be freaking out.
Are they slippery?
Yeah.
Yeah? All he knows is that he can't bring one home.
Except for a turtle.
Turtles are okay.
Just about everything is for sale. Some vendors, hoping to create new reptile enthusiasts, encourage squeamish sightseers to touch and hold the animals.
Okay, put your hand out in front, right? Oh, there he goes.
Others, like snake breeder Rich Perinello, seems more comfortable chatting with experienced reptile owners. He's the spitting image of the late James Gandolfini and the proud owner of 1 dog, 2 cats, and 800 snakes.
Snake people, I think, are more interesting. Reptile people alone are more interesting. It's a different type of pet. It's not a cuddly, soft, they don't need the emotion, the cuddle, the this or that. Some people think they do, but it's all per individual. It's a much neater thing to see, I guess, somebody walking down the street with a snake than somebody walking down the street with a dog on a leash, or, you know. That's how I feel. You know, everybody's entitled to their opinion.
Only a few minutes after the doors open at 10, a long line has already started snaking its way through the long hallways of the Radisson. Waiting patiently to get in, collector Nathalie Bragdon tells me what she thinks are the benefits and drawbacks of owning reptiles.
Some people don't like the idea of having to feed, say, mice or rats to their animals. They're an easier animal to take care of in the respect of they don't need to be fed and cleaned every single day like a mammal would. So there's different aspects to them.
A number of vendors and attendees are sporting tattoos, facial piercings, and black-on-black ensembles, perhaps the stereotypical look of a reptile enthusiast. But for many breeders, the interest in reptiles seems to stem less from a gothic fascination with scaly creatures as much as a genuine love of biology.
My name's Lisa, and I'm a breeder of crested geckos. They are fruit-eating geckos, so you don't have to feed them bugs. They eat a powder that's mixed with water.
As opposed to the snakes, which are mostly held in heavy plastic boxes, Lisa's crested geckos are housed in light plastic containers, the kind you get when you buy pasta salad at the deli.
They were thought to be extinct up until 1994, until they were rediscovered. And they're absolutely probably one of the softest lizards you'll ever touch, almost like suede when you touch them.
Walking slowly across the expo floor, I can see that almost all the action is taking place right up against the tables, except for one young vendor, that is, who's standing to one side and casually sporting a 3-foot boa constrictor around his neck like a living scarf.
This is a Colombian red-tailed boa. These are found in South America, around Colombia. You can walk around the expo, you'll see hundreds of these guys for sale, but right now there's people that are trying to make these illegal in legislation.
The snake leans its diamond-shaped head forward and interrupts the interview.
He's licking the mic right now.
Like most of these cold-blooded animals, he doesn't have much to say. Luckily, the vendor is happy to speak up for his tongue-tied friend.
They're just big puppy dogs, realistically. It's a shame how people view, like, the general public. I mean, I don't consider this expo the general public. You got people like me around here all day.
Not everything for sale is alive. Some tables are stacked with bulky chunks of driftwood, bark bedding, and other accessories designed to create a homey reptile environment. One seemingly empty booth sits discreetly among the rest. There aren't any brightly colored geckos or slithering snakes on this table. This vendor's wares are kept out of sight.
My name is Michael Hano, and I'm selling frozen rodents here today. People can buy a bag of 25 or 50 of whatever size they need and keep it in their freezer, and when they need to feed their animal, they take out, you know, whatever they're going to use that day and let it thaw out, just like you take meat out of your freezer before you cook it. And I actually have some frozen guinea pigs that are as big as some chihuahuas. Probably they weigh more. People eat them too, you know.
Okay. Thankfully, my son Phineas doesn't seem too interested in picking up a bag of chihuahua-sized frozen guinea pigs. He's discovered the only amphibians brave enough to hang out at a reptile show.
See all the little frogs, Finn?
Yeah.
How cute.
How cute.
On our way out, we catch up with all the attendees now holding their own little plastic containers, ready to take their new pets home.
What is it?
It's a Meller's chameleon.
I got two crested geckos. One's a female and one's a male.
I have a Pac-Man frog.
Let's see, a leopard gecko, a crested gecko.
My wife and I are only taking one wild animal home this year, and it sounds like he's ready for nap time.
It's okay, honey.
Maybe next year we'll pick up a turtle. For Word of Mouth, I'm Taylor Quimby.
You can see a slideshow of pictures from the New England Reptile Expo, along with links to many of the reptile vendors mentioned in Taylor's piece, at wordofmouthradio.org. You know my crawl in Kingsley, babe. And I rule my day. Okay, we've explored the hidden creatures slithering along the Earth's surface. Next, we cast our eyes upward to the farthest reaches of our solar system and beyond. The search for life among the stars, when Word of Mouth continues. You know you caught me crawling, baby, when the breath was very high. I'm just gonna keep on crawling now, baby, until the day I die. Become a crawler, can't sleep, baby.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In his Washington Post review of Lee Billings' book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude, the astronomer Mike Brown compressed the age of the Earth into a human lifetime. In just the past 2 weeks, he wrote, primates came down from the trees and learned to navigate among the planets. In the past few minutes, they figured out that the stars in the sky are suns like our own. 10 seconds ago, they realized that those suns have planets around them. And within the next minute, it seems likely that they will discover the first evidence of life on those planets in the sky. We are in that minute, according to the fast-growing field of exoplanets, the search for planets outside of our solar system, with the idea that discovering one just like ours is a real possibility. Science journalist Lee Billings writes about the fate of our planet and the scientist on the leading edge of identifying whether there are so-called Goldilocks planets, not too big, not too small, not too hot, not too cold, that can sustain life just like ours out there in the cosmos. Lee is on the line with us to talk about his book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude. Thank you for being here.
Virginia, it's great to be here.
Lee, I wonder if you could start off by reading just the first paragraph of your book, which kicks off this wonderful narrative of the evolution of the known universe. Now, this is some 4.6 billion years ago. Let's begin, please, with the very birth.
This story properly begins 4.6 billion years ago, with the birth of our solar system from a cloud of cold hydrogen and dust, several light years wide. The cloud was but a wisp from a much larger mass of primordial gas, a stellar nursery manufacturing massive stars destined to explode as supernovae. One by one, the giant stars popped off like firecrackers, ejecting heavy elements that sizzled with radioactivity as they rode shockwaves through the murk like so much scattered confetti. One of those enriching shockwaves may have compressed the cloud, our cloud, in its passage. The cloud became dense enough for gravity to seize control, and it collapsed in on itself. Most of its material fell to its center to form a hot, simmering protostar. Eventually, the protostar gained enough mass to kindle a thermonuclear fire at its core, and the sun began to shine. What was left of the cloud settled around the newborn star in a turbulent, spinning disk of incandescent vapor.
Lee Billings reading from the opening of his book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude. And thank you for that, Lee. I actually understood it while I was reading it. Where are we now in this evolution?
Well, we're kind of at the brink of amazing discoveries, potentially. The reason why I wrote the book right now was because we've been finding hundreds and actually now thousands of planets beyond the solar system, so-called exoplanets. And there's no real sign that the numbers of discoveries are going to slacken anytime soon. So you could soon be envisioning a world in which we know of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands even, of other solar systems, other planetary systems. And what that really means is that for the first time in the history of the biosphere, and perhaps the history of the universe, we're on the cusp of really discovering in some sense, whether or not we're special and whether or not we're alone, and all these kind of deep, timeless existential questions, we have a chance of answering them. And that was really, I think that's where we are now, and that's why I wrote the book.
I'm reading about more than 900 exoplanets have been identified in the past 20 years, another 1,000 suspected, new candidates appearing almost every week. Tell us how this field is pursued. How do we know where to go and look?
Well, we know now, based on some of those statistics you mentioned, that the sheer number of planets we've found through the relatively short time we've been looking, that we can look anywhere. We can look at essentially any star in the sky, and if we look hard enough, chances are we'll find some planets around it. The way that we find planets is through mostly indirect methods. We're mostly looking at the stars themselves because the planets are so faint and dim. We can't really see them directly most of the time. So instead, we're just looking for fluctuations of starlight, wobbling stars or stars that slightly dim every now and then from a planet passing across their face and casting a shadow towards Earth. And these indirect effects are how we have detected most of the vast majority of planets that we now know beyond the solar system.
So we know, or can at least predict, that at some point our planet will cease to exist. So for very practical reasons, our successors will need a home. In that way, the search for life in the distant reaches of the universe is no less than making sure that life itself continues. Is that, in general, how the scientists that you spoke with consider the search for life on other planets?
Well, maybe in their quiet nighttime moments, I think so. I wouldn't say that all of them see that as the forefront or the primary reason, perhaps, for why they do what they do. But it was definitely, again, a core thing for me when I was trying to write the book, just this notion that, you know, we don't really know right now where we kind of stand in the big scheme of things. And it could be, it's entirely plausible that we may be essentially alone in the Milky Way in terms of complex life, whatever you want to call it, intelligence, civilization, these sorts of things. And if that's the case, it kind of goes against centuries of thought in the physical sciences, which have said that we're average, we're ordinary, we don't matter, and everything out there is going to be just like it is here. And if that is the case, and we are practically alone, maybe in the galaxy or our region of the galaxy, if not the observable universe, then it seems that we have some kind of responsibility, I think, to try to preserve this little spark of life and light that we have here and extend it as we can. And that's obviously going to be important in the far future. But the point is, we do have actually some sense of an expiration date for life on Earth, if for no other reason than that the sun will someday cease to shine.
We're guessing 5 billion years from now?
5 billion years from now, the sun is supposed to swell up into what's called a red giant, and it will engulf most of the inner planets and melt them down to slag. And long before that, though, life on Earth will have probably wound down and essentially ended. And that could actually come as soon as 500 million years from now, which may sound like a long time, but in the lifespan of the Earth, that's basically like telling a 45-year-old woman that she has 5 years left to live. So our planet and the possibilities for complex life upon it are actually kind of already middle-aged and even elderly, perhaps. So we really don't have a lot of time left.
Not a great story. But you introduce us to several scientists who are working on finding life in other places, including Frank Drake. He's now professor emeritus at UC Santa Cruz. He was at a SETI conference back in 1961 when he came up with what is known as the Drake equation. Now, how did Frank Drake pursue that search?
Well, essentially, Frank Drake is best known as the, I think as you alluded right there, as the founder of SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. In mid-century, 20th century, he pointed a radio telescope at two sun-like stars, Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani, and listened for radio signals coming from them, basically thinking that perhaps in the same way that we pump radio signals and TV signals and things like that out into the cosmos, maybe some other people around other nearby stars were doing that. And Frank Drake started laying down these various variables that would pin down the chances of this search being successful. And so that incorporates things like how often stars are formed, how often planetary systems are formed around those new stars, how many habitable planets may exist in any given planetary system, how often life occurs and arises on those planets, how often that life progresses to intelligence and then to technology and something that can build radio telescopes or rockets and things like that. So you string all these variables together, and in theory, you get this number at the end, and that number should be the number of civilizations that may exist right now in our Milky Way that we could detect. And what he found was that the most important variable was not, in fact, the number of planets or the number of stars or how often life even got started. The most important numbers seem to be how long a civilization, a technological civilization like ours, actually exists, how long it survives. And that number, that variable in the equation is called L. So in some sense, the search for other life is really a search for our own future. We're trying to figure out how long we can persist, where we're going to go in the future. And we're looking out there into space and the depths of it, and we're trying to see things that are perhaps more advanced than us and where we might go someday.
Well, despite the importance of that search or that quest, when you visited Frank at SETI Institute, it looked as if it were in hibernation, you write. You know, there are weeds growing around these radio telescopes. And much of this story of the passion and mechanics of the search for exoplanets is also about the failures that go along the way, many for lack of funding and lack of political will. Can you locate that shift when funding or the pursuit of that discontinued, at least on a federal level, and who's picking it up?
Well, it's really been a slow slide. It's been a process of gradual decay. So, for instance, NASA and the federal government of the United States hasn't actually funded any SETI searches since 1992. So you could say that that's one cutoff point. But more recently, with the advent of what I like to call the exoplanet boom, there were several telescopes that were planned by NASA and several other space agencies, and they ended up being canceled for lack of funding. So the point is that there's no singular date you can pinpoint, but there's been a lot of, I guess, setbacks. And in terms of who's picking it up or where it's being picked up, that's a really good question. I'm not quite sure what the answer is. These are very, very difficult tasks. It's a very difficult thing to whether you're trying to go out and find another civilization out there or whether you're trying to just look for simple life on a planet very, very far away. It's not easy to do, and it's very expensive.
We're speaking with Lee Billings, science journalist. His work has appeared in Nature, New Scientist, and Scientific American, among other places. We're talking about his book, 5 Billion Years of Solitude. It is about the exoplanet boom and the search for life in any form on other planets far, far, far outside of our solar system. Lee, some of the other challenges are not in funding, but you alluded to it earlier about timing or perspective. You point out that if we were observing Earth from somewhere among the million stars of the Andromeda, we would see the Earth of 2.5 billion years ago. So at that point, forerunners of the Homo sapiens were producing stone tools, and go on from there, how the birth and evolution of our planet would look differently depending on where you sit in the universe. Can you go through that for us? It's so fascinating.
Well, sure. Yeah. So our galaxy is about 100,000 light years wide or so. So that means that on the other side of the galaxy, there's light right now from our planet, from our star, from our solar system that is trickling through the other side of the galaxy right now, and that light is about 100,000 years old. So if you think about what was happening on the planet 100,000 years ago, well, I guess you could talk to a geologist or a paleontologist, but I don't think there was a lot in terms of radio conversations or high technology. So what's important to think about is that in some ways, people or things out there very far away could know that we're here in some sense. But when I say we, I don't necessarily mean Virginia Prescott and Lee Billings. It would be more along the lines of knowing that the Earth was alive.
But that leads to the questions that planetary scientist Jim Castings discusses with you, that if we are searching for among exoplanets for signs of life, would we recognize it if we found it? You know, we might be looking at the analog planet 3 billion years ago. Would we say, oh, that's gonna turn into something?
Right, and that's a very good point. And this is something that researchers struggle with a lot, because usually in science, you don't want to base all of your extrapolations and all of your experiments off of a sample size of one. You don't want to just have one instance that you're, you know, drawing everything from. We really want to find a lot of other living planets, a lot of other habitable planets. And then if we did that, we would have a better idea of what the constraints actually are for life and what life in all its diversity can actually look like and how it manifests on planets. And we don't have a really good idea of that yet. So in some sense, you can look at the Earth's history, as Jim Casting has, and you can see that, you know, let's look 3 billion years ago. 3 billion years ago, the Earth had a pretty thriving biosphere. Things were relatively alien here. You and I wouldn't want to go back there and try to live there. We'd suffocate because there's no oxygen in the atmosphere, or there's very little of it. But at the same time, there was a thriving biosphere from microbes, single-celled organisms that could do things like metabolize all kinds of things like sulfur or hydrogen and use sunlight to split that stuff. And they some of them would produce methane. And there's a bunch of methane in the atmosphere. So you could think, well, maybe methane is a biosignature from back then. But, it's very tricky. And the point, I think, really is that we have to start from what we know. We're unfortunately blinkered in our view, but that's just the best we have. We have to base our search on what life seems to be like here because we know it pretty well. We understand it pretty well. And consequently, when we're looking for life out there, we're mostly looking for Earth-like planets. Even in our solar system, there's obviously other chances for life. Maybe there's life on Mars. Maybe there's life, in particular, in the ice-locked oceans of some of the moons in the outer solar system, like Jupiter's Europa or Saturn's Enceladus, things like that. But the thing is, and the trouble is, with those sorts of places, we could envision life being there, but if it's locked beneath a big shell of ice, for instance, how the heck are we going to detect it across the light years? So that's another reason why looking for an Earth-like planet is very attractive, because in that case, life would be all over the surface. It would, in theory, be ejecting byproducts of its metabolism into the atmosphere, these so-called biosignatures, and we could thus detect that from very, very far away using telescopes.
So we have things like we have telescopes. We have the Kepler mission, which is because of mechanical failure has been shuttered, at least temporarily. The plans for a terrestrial planet finder or TPF are looking pretty unlikely. Is this field losing steam, Lee Billings?
No. For Virginia, it's not. It's actually full steam ahead. The question is, it just depends on what we're trying to find. We're going to be finding a lot of planets. There's no sign of that slowing down. Planets are pouring out of the sky. They'll continue to do so for the foreseeable future. And that's because we've gotten really, really good at finding them, both from the ground and in space. But there will be what we risk, and this is a key thing that I wrote the book about. We risk a disconnect in between finding and detecting, discovering all these planets, and actually knowing what they're like. So in the very near future, it's entirely possible that you could walk outside, anyone on Earth could walk outside, and they could look up at the night sky. They could look at essentially any star in the sky, as we said earlier, and point to one of those stars and say, hey, we know that there's an Earth-mass, Earth-sized planet in the so-called habitable zone over there. It could be just like Earth. And they could do this for stars all across the sky they can point to. But we aren't actually going to know what they're like, and it'll just be a mystery. And the question is, do we want to go out there and actually discover what these places really are like? And whether or not they're really like Earth, whether or not they really have life, or if we're just going to be content to have that be a mystery.
Lee Billings, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia.
Lee Billings, science journalist and author of the book 5 Billion Years of Solitude. You can find more on the book, including some of the terrific reviews, at wordofmouthradio.org. Celebrations all over Russia for the Sochi Games, which kicked off yesterday. Stay with us for a journey about 2,000 miles from the Olympic Village to Siberia. It is in those tiny, remote towns where pre-adolescent girls are parading for international modeling scouts. We're going to learn about the shadowy search for the next supermodel when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Sochi Games have turned the eyes of the world to Russia's spotty record with human rights, government corruption, and its complicated social and political history in the Caucasus region. Our next story shifts to another part of rural Russia for a closer look at a high-stakes industry, the search for the next supermodel. The documentary film Girl Model follows the trafficking of Russian child models to the Japanese fashion market, a staging ground for the international fashion industry. It is an unflinching look at the global market's insatiable drive for images of youth. The film tracks Ashley Arbach as she scours rural beauty pageants for the next great face. The girls are typically poor, mostly looking for a way out, and often as young as 12 or 13, though passed off as 15 by their agencies. Girl model profiles one of the hopefuls, 13-year-old Nadia. She's a self-described gray mouse of a country girl who's selected as an elite star and sent to Tokyo for a shot at becoming a professional model. I spoke to Ashley Sabin, one of the filmmakers, when Girl Model premiered on POV. You can now watch it instantly on Netflix. I asked Ashley what daily life was like for a young girl in a Siberian village.
A lot of times these girls, and specifically Nadia, come from very rural backgrounds. So they're coming from outside the city into the big city to audition for their 10 seconds in front of these scouts. She lived with her family, her mother and father, you know, as a whole unit. And I think it was really their sort of wanting something different for Nadia, wanting her to not only gain money, but also gain experience traveling that they felt they couldn't provide for their daughter, that pushed them all to have Nadia try out for these castings.
And you kind of get the impression that all of these young girls and their families probably have a similar aspiration. And one could take the charitable view of helping poor girls find a better way. That's the one expressed anyway by Tigran, who owns the Noah modeling agency. Let's hear from him.
The concept of Noah was simple. Just like Noah saved all the animals, I'm trying to save all these young girls. That's what I'm doing. I'm putting them on the plane, sending them to the West, giving them a chance where they can find themselves, develop as women, grow as individuals, and I hope that someday they'll do some good to the other people. So in a way, for me, this is a religious matter. You know, this is my Bible.
Okay, so savior or cog in the supply chain. Ashley, are we left to make that decision ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, that's how we really frame the story through the editing, because it's important to us that the viewer has an opportunity to evaluate the different characters, the different situations, and come to their own conclusions about how does this network happen? Who's involved? Who are these girls? What are their hopes and dreams? So it's more sort of provoking questions than it is answers, and the typical sort of who's the bad guy, who's the good guy kind of mentality doesn't exist in our film.
Well, it puts you in an interesting position also as a filmmaker. There's a scene where Nadia arrives at the airport in Tokyo. There's no one there to meet her, absolutely no way to communicate. You know, she's pointing to her dictionary to try and speak to somebody. And she turns to your colleague David for help. What kind of position does that put you in as a filmmaker?
It's an ethically really tricky position because, you know, here we have this 13-year-old girl and we're adults and we also speak English, so we're able to understand more of what's going on than Nadia, who just speaks Russian. And the question is always at Q&As, why didn't you step in? Because we frame the film as if we're not there, but in fact, we're there the entire, you know, journey, and we're constantly intervening. You know, our whole mentality was to really not exasperate Nadia any more than she needed to be, but we're also documentary filmmakers, so documenting the situation as truthful as it was. So we would take it on a case-by-case basis, and with Nadia arriving at the airport, what you don't see in the film is that we, in fact, immediately call her mother. And with our dictionary and our very almost non-functioning, broken Russian, try to communicate to her, you know, this is where we are. We're at the airport. What should we do? So, you know, it was a constant negotiation.
And it makes us, the viewer, think, you know, how many other girls arrive there absolutely alone, absolutely unequipped at 12 or 13 for this. And then they're marching around, you know, once they get to their destination, marching around like cattle from place to place to be judged, to be measured. No money to go out, certainly. It looks like a pretty sad existence.
I think the age makes it really tricky. You know, when you have someone who's starting at 13 years old and is taken out of her peer group, taken out of school, taken away from her family, and then gets to a foreign location and such a big metropolis like Tokyo and is trying to navigate that city, the adult world that she's in, it begs the question of, like, who's responsible for this? You know, how is this possible? And is the rest of the industry like this? And in fact, models have shown up to our screenings and said, that's my experience too. So it, you can't just say it's Russia. It's actually happening in Italy. It's happening in Paris. It's happening in New York, all these major fashion capitals.
We're speaking with Ashley Sabin. She and David Redman have together produced and directed several documentary feature films. Their latest film, Girl Model, is making its broadcast premiere on PBS's POV on Sunday. Most fascinating, I think, as a character in your film is Ashley Arbach, not to be confused with you, Ashley Sabin. She's the scout. We see from videos that she made at the time that she went through this process herself as a young woman and was terrified. How does she look at her role in keeping this supply chain, I guess, going?
Yeah, Ashley's a really interesting person. And then she's also, you know, her role in the film is really interesting because she started out as a model. She started when she was 17 years old. And now as a scout. And there's one scene actually in the film where she's at her house in Connecticut and she talks about the transition from being a model to becoming a scout and how she then was able to have control, finally having control. So I think that there's a number of things that Ashley says and does that audiences can't understand her motivations and they need an explanation. But to me, what's really fascinating is you have this woman who is involved in an industry that she knows very, very intimately, both ends of it, and she continues to be involved in it. So it sort of shows the cyclical nature of things. It also begs the question of, you know, is this going to be Nadia when Nadia is 30 years old? Will she be a scout as well?
You can see the path very clearly of exploitation. These girls in their contracts, they can't go swimming, they can't be out in the sun, they can't gain more than 1 centimeter in their waist or hips. In fact, Madeline, Nadia's best friend and kind of lifeline, is sent home for gaining more than 1 centimeter in her hips. And so is Nadia, because she doesn't have the 2 jobs necessary to stay by terms of her Japanese visa, and she leaves $2,000 in debt. Why is she in debt?
Yeah, the debt was something that Dave and I took a while to wrap our heads around. Basically, everything is debt, whether it's her airplane ticket, the visa, the photocopies that are coming out of those machines, the photographers that are taking test shoots of her. Each girl is paying $1,500 a month for their apartment. So it's sort of endless. Like, you know, the debt can be anything, essentially. And that's something that Nadia, when her and her family were given the contract, that wasn't explained to them. And additionally, I should also note that the contract was in Russian and Japanese. So they weren't able to even understand at a basic level what they were getting involved in. And that was translated by the local Russian agency.
In fact, there's a scene in the film where David, your colleague, asks a man named Messiah, funnily enough, the owner of Switch, which is the Japanese modeling agency, about the financial arrangement. Let's hear from it.
I don't understand how new girls like Nadia and Madeline can make you money, can make Tigran money, can make Ashley money.
From new faces, I think we can make money. Just they can get, you know, like experiences. That's all. Or new pictures. I think agency cannot make it from new faces, I think.
So if they don't make money, then why do you bring them in?
Okay, not a real answer there. These girls come away maybe with photographs, maybe not, maybe with experiences, maybe not. Somebody's making money. Ashley has a pretty nice house there in Connecticut.
Yeah, that's the question, right? I mean, who's profiting? And it's certainly not Nadia or Madeline. And we never really got straight answers. You know, is Switch making the money? Is Noah Models making the money? Is Ashley making the money? It's hard to know, and that transparency just doesn't exist in the industry.
I also was struck that after watching this film, then I'm at the New York Times and I'm looking at the, you know, Milan fashion shows or whatever, you know, scrolling through these pictures and looking at these girls for the first time thinking, oh, my God, she could be 15. So, you know, I'm sort of asking myself, how are we complicit as viewers in all of this?
Exactly. I mean, that to me was such a disturbing thing to take away from the whole project. Was that when you walk down the street, an image is looking down at you, what I began to realize that there's so much more behind that image than what's at the surface. The surface is really shiny and glamour and lights and mirrors. But then when you really look beyond that image, what's the labor involved? What's the cost involved? How old are these girls? And, you know,
if we have young, really young girls modeling adult clothing, what does that do for women's and men's perception of female body image?
Ashley Sabin there, co-director of the documentary film Girl Model. You can now watch the film instantly on Netflix. There's a link to do so, wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you for joining us today. If you did miss any of the show, don't fret. The entire show is now available as a daily podcast, so you never have to miss out on the conversation. You can find a link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, or search for Word of Mouth on iTunes. And if you like the show, please tell a friend or pass it along. After all, the best suggestions tend to travel by word of mouth. We hope you enjoy the rest of your weekend and get out and play in the snow. We'll be back with more next week on NHPR and online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org. Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.